and this is the Laura Flanders Show, a TV and radio program that shines a light on the solutions of tomorrow today. We report on the people and movements driving systemic change from the worlds of politics, arts, and entrepreneurship. Welcome.
It's been a difficult couple of years, and I'm not just talking about COVID. People have faced racism, sexism, economic exploitation, and violence at disturbing levels. But a few months ago, I went to see my first live theater piece since the shutdown began, and it was at the New York Theater Workshop, one of my favorite East Village locations. The show I saw there brought me back to life. Christina Wong, Sweatshop Overlord, is a look back on the last 2 years with fury, but also humor, and it's kind of inspirational to boot. That's because in it, Wong tells the story of how she, a performance artist and comedian, founded what she perhaps hastily named the Auntie Sewing Squad, a network of primarily Asian American women who ended up sewing over 500,000 masks for medical workers and people in need all over this country. Today, I am joined by Christina and another one of the aunties who contributed to the project, historian, activist, and author of over 20 books, Rebecca Solnit. They're two of the many contributors to a new book, The Auntie Sewing Squad Guide to Mask Making, Radical Care, and Racial Justice, which is out now from the University of California Press. Christina and Rebecca, I am so excited to jump into this life-saving conversation. But first, let's go to the moment in the show when you, Christina, describe becoming a sweatshop overlord.
Now, it is nobody's dream to do anyone's laundry for a living. But when the yellow peril came to America, white people did not like that immigrants were coming for their jobs. So laundry was the only work Chinese people could do at the time, because it was considered women's work. And in me, their college-educated granddaughter, their dreams of Gold Mountain have come wildly alive. I am the default leader of these aunties, ensuring a machine-like output from our bodies threaten to snip the fingers off any slackers, making the masks that the most powerful country in the world has failed to provide. This is my ancestral destiny. I am the Sweatshop Overlord!
Take us back 2 years ago. Where were you in 2020, and how did this performance piece that is so much more than that find its start?
At the top of 2020, I was set to tour a show called Christina Wong for Public Office. I had ran for public office in Koreatown, Los Angeles, because I wasn't sure what to do with myself as an artist anymore. We were living in times where artists and politicians had switched jobs. They were the ones creating shock and spectacle. And it felt like artists were left in the position to kind of create community and social change. And it didn't make sense to make theater anymore that was like, look how ridiculous the world is, because we were sort of clear that we were living in that. The show played twice. My last live show for an audience was on March 12, 2020 in Sacramento. And the tour was cut short. I was deemed non-essential, as most artists were. I sew my set pieces and props for my shows, and saw that hospitals were looking for home sewn masks. And I went, oh my God, I have one essential skill. I have one essential skill, and I can save nurses with it. And 4 days later, on March 24th, 2020, I thought, okay, I'll start a Facebook group to try to find other people who are sewing, and maybe they can pass their excess masks to me to fulfill these requests. And I called the group Auntie Sewing Squad in a rush, not realizing our acronym is ASS. And I thought we were going to be a three-week project. We went on for 17 months. We grew to having over 800 aunties across 33 states. We were doing relief van drives from LA to the Navajo Nation. We did 8 of those. We did coat drives to Standing Rock. We also helped facilitate getting a lot of medical and hygiene supplies to Lakota folks. We redistributed hundreds and thousands of dollars of hygiene and medical supplies to farm workers in indigenous communities.
It's an extraordinary story. And I think it, at least last count that I saw was something like 500,000 masks you got out there. And you were getting requests from all sorts of people who should have had their own supplies, but instead were relying on the Auntie Sewing Squad. Well, what about you, Rebecca? How did you come across the Auntie Sewing Squad? And how did you become a part of it, really?
One of the OG aunties is my friend Valerie So, who I've known since the 80s. She's an Asian American Studies professor at San Francisco State. She told me it was happening, and I thought I was just coming on as a journalist to witness what was happening, because I could tell that this was going to be a remarkable mutual aid group. And, you know, I've written about disaster and the way communities respond positively in disaster, new communities cohere. This was something remarkable I wanted to witness. But of course, you see needs and you get drawn in. I'm a very mediocre, slow seamstress, so I did not make any masks for the squad, but I helped fundraise and organize and, you know, got hundreds of coats with the Lakota coat drives and sewing machines to the Navajos and did witness what was happening and got to know a lot of people. And it is truly the most remarkable mutual aid project I've ever seen in many, many ways.
So Rebecca's official title is our historian writer shakedown auntie. So I, because she would post something and it was like, boom, donations, boom, support, boom, fabric, like when all, so she's being very modest, but she's the historian writer shakedown auntie, which I believe is your bio in certain spaces.
I love that title. The Auntie Sewing Squad may be retired, but not over, and I'm keeping the title.
We are the cavalry. If the cavalry wore mom jeans and sensible shoes and always know the cheapest hours at the buffet. That's a lot of Asian women. Is this a coincidence? No! Sewing was passed down to us from our mothers and grandmothers, who learned it as a rite of passage to America.
Why is it so often women that leap into the breach, Rebecca?
You know, we could reframe that as like, what the hell is up with men? And, because we're always sort of creating all these things is about women that are often about men. You know, violence against women could be retitled violence by men, etc. But, you know, I think women, we're socialized as caregivers and we're socialized to be altruistic and to take care of other people. We're often socialized to believe that we're completely selfish if we're not doing it frantically all the time. I suppose I could mention that there were uncles and male aunties and people who did not identify as either aunties or uncles in our group. It was quite diverse, but primarily female and primarily Asian American. You know, naming it the Auntie suggested kinship among the group, kinship to really all beings, all impacted people, and a kind of playfulness, as well as all the interesting roles aunties play in various Asian, African American, indigenous, and, you know, white Southern cultures that I know of.
Now, you never did become a charity or a business. Talk about why, Christina, and how did you choose the people that you were going to help?
I didn't even know what mutual aid was until someone was like, what you're doing is mutual aid. And I was like, I didn't go to that conference. What is that term? And I looked it up and I was like, oh, it's sort of like doing the work of a charity, but without the board of directors, the salary, the overhead, and all the red tape that's involved with that. And it was suggested to us a lot, like, you could become a nonprofit. And I was like, I don't want to, because I think we're basically meeting a need as it exists. And this sort of style of gathering and organizing has allowed us to be much more flexible with our resources, which is why the actual government, which is why these nonprofits are turning to us, because we have a flexibility and an ability to respond and move around barriers the way they cannot.
In the show, you frame the Sewing Squad as not just a mutual aid project, but as insurgents against racial injustice and economic injustice, and particularly looking at the pandemic's relationship to anti-Asian racism.
So masks to stop the COVID pandemic? But the CDC says we don't have to wear masks right now unless we're already sick. And personally, I'm not wearing a mask right now because I am trying to protect myself. Not from the virus, but from being the target of harassment and assault. Okay, see, it doesn't matter if I'm third generation Chinese American. This is a mask I cannot take off. It already says, maybe I'm an immigrant from the monolith that is Asia. Maybe I don't speak English. Maybe I'm the one who brought this virus here.
When I'm screaming to the internet, who knows how to sew? Who knows how to sew? They were all like Asian women who stepped up. And that's because our mothers and our grandmothers did this as a survival skill when they got to America. And we had aunties whose experiences of growing up were helping their mothers cut piecework on the floor and helping cut rows of sleeves. And it was hard to not see the irony of that. Everyone was like mad at Asian Americans at the top of this pandemic because of this perception that we somehow brought this virus or carrying it. And yet what I was witnessing is like, we're the ones doing this unpaid labor and trying to protect everyone right now.
This is so often the case, Rebecca, of the stories that you write about, the very people who are not served by the system know how to jump into that breach and get it done. The aunties know how to get it done. How do you think about that now? Because, you know, I'm trying desperately not to use that word resilience, because people shouldn't have to be this resilient.
It was interesting to see the aunties both as a sort of Asian American centered group resisting the demonization and marginalization of people of color and Asian people in particular, and also to see women doing bottom line work, which so often happens, but doing it not in a kind of nice, submissive, sewing circle kind of way. There were a bunch of sewing groups some of our members came from where you weren't supposed to talk about politics. And Christina, as the leader, or as we call her, our overlord, sweatshop overlord, I believe is the title of in her performance, really welcomed these radical discussions. So it felt quite radical to have groups that are sometimes silenced and marginalized taking a lot of power to come together to redefine what was right and just and fair, to connect to each other. And one of the things that was really striking is that it was building a lot of community for the aunties, because, you know, obviously we were giving masks to people who needed them, and we saw people just getting out of prison, refugees, farm workers, et cetera, getting masks. But also in the pandemic, people felt really isolated. They often lost their sense of purpose and community. And the anti-sewing squad was providing that for each other. And I think I'm far from alone in saying that I have what are probably permanent friendships that have come out of what happened in those 17 months.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. My guests are members of the Auntie Sewing Squad, a mutual aid group pulled together by performance artist, costume sewer, and sometime politician Christina Wong. She recently starred in a one-woman show based on her experience called Sweatshop Overlord, which ran for weeks this winter at the New York Theatre Workshop. With Wong is Rebecca Solnit, lovingly referred to as the Sewing Squad's historian, writer, and shakedown auntie. Solnit, who doesn't sew, helped raise support for the squad and attention. She's an activist and historian who's authored over 20 books on feminism, popular power, and together she and Wong are contributors to a new book, The Auntie Sewing Squad Guide to Mask Making, Radical Care, and Racial Justice. You can watch this episode and see clips from Christina Wong's show at our website, LauraFlanders.org. While you're there, sign up for our weekly alerts and receive information on all of our streaming events and web exclusives, including uncut versions of our interviews and regular commentaries from me. Next, Christina talks about the making of Sweatshop Overlord and the role of joy in a time of, well, exasperation. But first, here is DJ Eno's remix of Mystery of Life by Nicodemus, featuring Andrea Montero from the Turntables on the Hudson Lost and Found in the Frying Pan collection.
Is it the sign of doubt?
talk about making the piece that you've made, Sweatshop Overlord, Christina, which holds those two things so beautifully together in its hands for us in the audience, both the fury at the rise of anti-Asian violence against especially Asian American women in this period, the work that you're doing, and somehow also the joy and defiance in what you're doing.
It felt like the only, in a moment where we were feeling so helpless, point we can't even leave our house or buy groceries without wondering if we're going to die. It felt like, well, by sewing, this is how we fight. This is how we do this war. And it also felt like in war movies, which I looked at a lot of when I was trying to figure out how to write this show, there's, you know, it's not just about pow, pow, pow fighting, because that's what guns sound like, pow, pow,
yeah,
pow.
That's right, that's right.
But there's a camaraderie among the soldiers. There's this complete disillusionment as to why we're fighting. There's frustration at the system that is treating us like fodder. And these were all sort of emotions that we felt in this time. Like, does no one care that we're sewing? Is this even making a difference?
And then in the middle of it, you have the police murder of George Floyd.
Dear George Floyd, you don't know me. Our worlds are very different. But I watched you die on my Facebook timeline. I didn't realize when I first scrolled past that blurry, unfortunately familiar image of that white cop's knee on your neck that that was you being murdered, executed. I thought, oh God, here is another upsetting image of a white cop being brutal to an unarmed black person. And I chose to scroll past. That was privilege that I had in that moment, to scroll past the image of your lynching on my timeline and hope that maybe this is a picture from the before times. Maybe this is a black person whose name we've already spoken and mourned and continue to mourn. George Floyd, I want justice for you and all those who've been murdered by state-sponsored violence.
Our super auntie Jessica had called upon us to sew masks for the NAACP's in the hometowns of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, as a way of sewing with intention, offering protection that, you know, we couldn't be there at that parking lot and pull that cop off of George Floyd, like the way we wanted to when we witnessed these video clips. But we could at least offer these tokens and this form of protection in these masks. Mm. And so that we began to shift our attention to these communities that we felt like were getting disproportionately hit by the virus, getting disproportionately just hit in general by white supremacy, and sending them support in that way.
So how do you think about what endures? And Rebecca, I know this is a question that you raise, for example, in the new introduction to your 2009 book, A Paradise Built in Hell. You say, you know, one of the questions you have about the stories that you tell of disasters and creative responses to crisis is, why doesn't it last? How do you think about longevity in this context?
You know, what you often see in the disasters, and I was looking at earthquakes, explosions, hurricanes like Hurricane Katrina, et cetera, is that all normalcy kind of falls apart, institutional authority fails, and ordinary people self-organize to create the shelters, rescue the neighbors, build a soup kitchen, improvise the conditions of survival. And often people find a real joy and meaning in that work that connects them more deeply to each other, has more value than the work, you know, making widgets for widget.com that they may be doing. But often people, particularly in this country, seem to then just go, you know, what we call going back to normal without really questioning it. We saw that in 9/11 in New York City too. But not everybody goes back. A lot of people are like, this is who I want to be. My values are changed. My sense of my own possibilities are changed. My realization that I can connect to community and how important it is has changed. And they don't really go back.
This is making me think of our auntie Anne, who was a wedding planner before this. And obviously that whole industry shut down. And now she works at Peace Over Violence working on their donations and fundraising, right? And she actually has shifted into doing mutual aid and supporting her unhoused neighbors in South Pasadena. It's relatively small compared to the unhoused population in Los Angeles, but she has like a very personal relationship with them. And our other auntie Candace, also does food delivery to seniors in Chinatown because they don't have a grocery store in LA Chinatown anymore, right? And a lot of this has been supported by other aunties. Some aunties have taken turns when Candace can't go, like driving the food over, or they've supported Anne with stuff. And we're still doing things. Like, I guess one thing that has struck a lot of us is some of us, I joke that I was inherently selfish before this. I was a performance artist. Like, there's no more self, like, no, look at me, look at me, look at me. Like, that's a very selfish, you know, a field that I'm in where I'm constantly like, no, you have to stop, look at me. And so to shift into this very generous side of, I've never felt so generous in my life, and to connect to all these people. Like in LA, it's very weird to not be networking all the time. And instead I would just be meeting people outside my building because they had elastic and they were going to bring it to me and were willing to risk their life to go outside to bring me a spool of elastic, some old quilt projects. And I just felt this like respect and love in my heart for these people I'd never met before, to the point, and I described this in the show, that they're driving away and I'm screaming, I love you. And I'm who am I right now? But there is this like very intense love and this culture of love and care within our group.
Aunties, we have been warned about this second spike for months. Holiday gatherings of six or more, super spreader rallies, no mask wearing mandates in states like Montana, North Dakota, Florida, Georgia. Pfizer and Moderna shots are trickling in, but not fast enough to blanket all civilians. And that is where we come in. We will not concede. We will not give up.
Other question, Rebecca, which is one that Christina poses throughout the show, is America a banana republic disguised as a democracy?
You can certainly make a case for that. And we still have enough freedoms to do a lot of counter-organizing. And, people have, you know, some of us more than others. And of course, the anti-sewing squad was about going against the tide of the Trump administration and ideology and impact, you know, in very obvious ways, like supporting and promoting masks when masks were being more or less demonized. And, we're a republic with some democratic and some autocratic tendencies. And I think right now we're in a kind of Gotterdammerung kind of final battle between democracy and authoritarianism and voting rights for everything, human rights, reproductive rights, climate justice, et cetera, are all tied together. We're going to decide in the next few years which direction we go. And the pandemic just brought a lot of that to the fore.
If we were going to learn from the aunties, you have a wonderful website, Christina, and you have your values and principles laid out there. There's quite a few. I'm not going to ask you to rattle them all off. But if we were going to learn from the auntie squad as we head into 2022, auntie sewing squad, what would be the key learnings?
I think that this was a moment to learn that, like, I think I was shocked at myself because I always imagined in the rapture that I'd be the one like fighting everyone with a pipe and running off with my belongings and moving in a scarcity mode. But I think there's something that we all have to give and offer to each other. And this is not to say like, give away all your belongings and then you're destitute. But I think that to take a pause and say, what do I have to offer and where can I be of support in the situation? And to act on that versus fear and me, I'm in it for me. And I think that generosity really will open a whole new way of understanding how to act in crisis and understanding what power you actually have in the situation and is actually very useful to others.
And it might make you kind of happy along the way.
Yeah.
If people missed your show at the New York Theatre Workshop or the streaming that happened afterwards, are they still able to catch it? Will they be able to catch it this year?
I hope so. We're working on a tour, but no dates are confirmed as of this interview. So I recommend that you pick up our book, The Auntie Sewing Squad, Guide to Mask Making, Radical Care and Social Justice. I feel like that's a wonderful account. Rebecca's holding it. A wonderful account of what our work has been and a way to sort of experience it in lieu of seeing the live show. But please keep your eye open. And hopefully it will come to a theater near you.
Let's hope so. Rebecca, what are you working on?
Oh, just, you know, the usual, writing essays about reproductive rights, climate, and everything else under the sun. A 300-year-old violin, and, you know, which just ties to climate in the way I'm writing about it. The usual.
I can't wait to see more from you, Rebecca. And absolutely, Christina, the next time you're in town, I am going to come and see whatever it is that you do. And I will try to practice the principles of the Sewing Squad in this year, which looks like it's going to need every one of them. Thank you so much. The great thing about calling your squad aunties is that auntie is an identity it's very hard not to like. As Rebecca Solnit says today, auntie comes with a sense of the familial without the nuclear, with a sense of belonging without the baggage, if you like. As we look back over the last 12 months, many people today are talking about that sense of belonging that seems to be missing in so many places in a society that many seems to be coming apart. As we look at what happened January 6th in the Capitol, you have rioters who say they were just wanting to be part of something, that they were taken up with the herd instinct. And you have prosecutors who say, well, that herd instinct left 150 police officers injured and 5 people dead. Sure enough, you can't have a riot without rioters, and you can't have a society without people who feel that they're a part of it. But something else happened a year ago, too, that we would be foolish to forget, which is that more Americans than ever signed up to participate in their democracy, and people in all sorts of historically very segregated places, from Native American reservations to southern states like Georgia, came together to cast votes that tipped the balance in Congress. So while we look at both sides of this story, on this program we like to remember that where we focus grows. And I'd like to thank Christina Wong and Rebecca Solnit for reminding me to focus on belonging of a more sewing squad sort. A mutual aid organization that wasn't in fact a sweatshop, was indeed a society that looked after its participants of every sort and gave me an experience of belonging, again, live in a theater. I was glad to do it, and I hope to do it again soon. Thank you for that. For more information on this week's guests, go to patreon.com/theLF show, where you'll also find a suggested reading list and additional related episodes to explore from our archives. That's also where you can find information about how to watch the premiere of every week's episode with us on YouTube at 11:30 Eastern Sundays and take part in the live chat with my guests and myself. All the details are at patreon.com/theLF show. And while you're there, you have a great opportunity to become a Patreon partner. We're independent, but we do depend on listener support. Our Patreon partners bring us monthly support to keep this programming coming free on public television, on community radio, and as a podcast all year. Join them by committing to a monthly contribution of $3, $5, or more. Go to patreon.com/theLF show and become a member today. A big thanks this time to all of our Patreon partners and everyone who contributed to our holiday fund drive. We met our match, and we'll have much more about that next time. Thanks for listening. This show is produced by yours truly, Laura Flanders, with Matt Colicello, Sabrina Artell, Jeremiah Cothran, Rory O'Connor, Nat Needham, Charlotte Carpenter, Jeannie Hopper, Ryan Hotz, Lee Friedman, and Jeanette Hernandez. Major funding for this program is provided by the Novo Park, Ellen Poss Family, Hisuku Wilson Foundations, the Schumann Media Center, Rising Fund at Tides, Kim Connor and Nick Groombridge, Jane Fonda, and listeners like you. Thanks for contributing. Thanks for your ideas. Stay kind, stay curious. Until the next time, I'm Laura.